Good morning, this is AM, I'm Chris Yuleman. Troubled Thailand is back under military rule. Less than a decade since the last coup d'etat, the army has overthrown the government and suspended the constitution. It's also moved quickly to disperse protesters and black out all major television networks, including international outlets like the BBC. There were also threats that the internet and social media sites would be shut down. Southeast Asia correspondent Samantha Hawley reports from Bangkok.
2 days after declaring martial law, the Thai military took the step so many were expecting. At 4:30 p.m., the army chief, Prayut Chan-o-cha, began a nationally televised address. It was clear a coup was underway. It's time, he says, to seize control of the situation in the country and to bring the situation back to normal quickly. Political and protest leaders who'd been called to a meeting chaired by the army general to discuss a way forward for Thailand were taken into custody and detained at an army base just before the announcement was made. The interim prime minister had said he was too busy to attend the meeting and so remained free from military detention. But he had no power or cabinet left. At an anti-government rally site in the centre of the city, the army moved in to disperse the crowd, and they willingly left. After more than 6 months of disruptive street protests, they're claiming victory. I am very happy, this man tells me. I'm very excited that the soldiers came to help solve the country's problems. I want soldiers to use their power fully, this woman says. People have been fighting for a long time. There were dramatic scenes at a pro-government red shirt rally site, reports of gunfire. But soon after, protesters began to disperse from there too. The question is, will they be back? The red shirts won't allow this to happen. We will fight, this man tells me. During his televised address, the army chief tells the nation people should remain calm and carry on with their business as usual. Tanks didn't roll onto the streets as Thailand has seen in the past. This was a softer coup with a build-up, but the same rules apply. Most television stations were taken off air, including international news broadcasters. There was a military threat to shut down the internet and social media sites, and a 10 p.m. until 5 a.m. curfew is in place. So it's life as normal under military rule. This is Samantha Hawley in Bangkok reporting for AM.
Indigenous groups fear an Abbott government budget decision will make it much harder to close the gap. The Council of Australian Governments Reform Council will be scrapped in June and has now released its final report on Indigenous affairs. Leading Aboriginal figures say the independent reports the Council provides are vitally important. And without them, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander policy may as well be written on the back of a beer coaster. From Canberra, James Glenday reports.
There are a few policy areas more vexed for the major parties than Indigenous affairs. There have been numerous expensive failures and reliable information has been scarce.
So we need this data. We need good data to see where we're going really well and the parts that aren't working so well. We know we've got to put a bigger effort in those areas.
The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, Mick Gooder, is concerned about the federal government's decision to scrap the COAG Reform Council. The Independent Council was set up in 2006. It collates data to check if states, territories and the Commonwealth are meeting agreed targets in several policy areas, including Indigenous affairs.
If we don't have decisions made on the basis of the best evidence that we have available to us, we'll forever be just, you know, might as well be just making up things on the back of beer coasters again.
Scrapping the council will save about $8 million, and Commonwealth departments or other COAG councils will take on the duties. But Kirsty Parker from the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples says the data is unlikely to be free from government spin or bias.
There needs to be a measure of objectivity, I guess.
She says the Commonwealth risks wasting money on failed programs if it doesn't set up a new independent body to oversee Indigenous affairs targets.
It's important that it be outside of the realm of, you know, the departments, the bureaucracies, etc., that are meant to be administering programs that address these things.
The Council's final report into Indigenous affairs over the past 5 years is largely unsurprising. life expectancy is improving, but not fast enough to close the gap by 2031. Smoking rates are declining, obesity is still a problem, and so is school attendance. There are fewer child deaths, reading and primary level numeracy are improving, and more Aboriginal people are completing Year 12. But the gap in unemployment has widened.
5 years is a reasonable amount of time, but, you know, it's not a long amount of time to really measure clear and significant change.
Former Victorian Premier John Brumby is the head of the COAG Reform Council. He says it's worked as an independent umpire in state-Commonwealth relations.
Whenever you've got governments working together, who is there to properly measure against the milestones governments want from the taxpayers' money they're investing? I think that's the point.
Labor's Indigenous Affairs spokesman Shane Newman says the Abbott government and some states no longer want the scrutiny.
COAG reports like this sometimes really vex governments, but they need to prick the conscience of the country and prick the conscience of the nation.
None of the senior ministers or premiers AM approached were available for interview.
James Glenday reporting. It was one of humanity's greatest plagues, claiming hundreds of millions of lives, and its eradication was one of medicine's greatest triumphs. But 30 years after smallpox was wiped out, stocks of the variola virus still exist. The World Health Organization's governing body will today decide what to do with the remaining virus stocks. Agreement has already been reached on the need to destroy them, but some researchers argue scientific study of smallpox must continue. Emily Burke has the story.
A global vaccination drive wiped out smallpox in the 1980s, but samples of the virus still exist and are stored in high-security labs in Russia and the United States. The stocks are ostensibly for scientific purposes, but the World Health Organization has agreed that there's no longer any need to keep live variola specimens. But not everyone is on the same page, and the debate is expected to intensify within the General Assembly of the WHO, and there'll be a vote in Geneva as early as today over if and when the last traces should be destroyed completely and forever.
This is the opportunity for the global community to come together and grapple with some, I think, very difficult decisions.
Inga Damon is a variola virus expert at the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
So we think the remaining variola materials have been quite usefully used over the past 10 years to advance public health research. So we've been working on diagnostics development, on antiviral evaluation, and on vaccine evaluation. Critical elements of the research need to be done with variola itself. I think we've made tremendous progress, and it's really expanded our capacity to have applied outcomes that we can use should disease ever be reintroduced. And that's the reason we're doing this work.
What is the point of keeping this? This is a risk that we are putting everybody at for no great benefit other than somebody's intellectual curiosity.
Dr. Peter Collignon is Professor of Infectious Diseases at the ANU.
There is still a desire for some to principally have it for biological warfare. And so the major countries that are keeping it are supposedly research to keep it just in case one of the other people that might in some combat with them, we should release it.
Is there any justification at all for keeping it for pure research?
Well, I don't think there is, because stocks that have been kept before, we've already had one accident where it leaked a number of decades ago and resulted in the death of someone. So I can't see any valid reason. I mean, there's a risk and I can't see any benefit. If people argue that, you know, somebody might have a secret stockpile that nobody knows about. We know enough about smallpox on how to eradicate it and have vaccines for it. And in any case, if that should actually happen, we could easily get the virus again and do all the research I would think we need very quickly to see how it's been modified and what we need to do to combat it. We've got all the photographs, electron microscopy, we know what's DNA, we've got all the information we need to readily fingerprint it and identify it, and we are better off if this thing is wiped out of existence so that it can never return.
Dr. Peter Collignon is Professor of Infectious Diseases at the ANU. Emily Burke with that report. You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 20 minutes past 7. And still to come, Japan has the world's oldest population. One quarter of its 127 million people is aged 65 or over. Now it's facing a dementia epidemic. In the United States, a woman who was kidnapped and abused for 10 years has spoken about being reunited with her family. Police say the woman, who doesn't want to be identified, was just 15 when her mother's boyfriend took her away, changed her identity, and eventually married and had a child with her. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
It was August 2004 when the woman was first sexually assaulted and then allegedly drugged and taken away from her family. Now she's been reunited with her mother and sister.
I'm so happy and God bless to be with my family. That I want all the time I cry for her, for them, more for my mom and my sisters.
Holding her three-year-old daughter, her back to a TV news camera, she says that during the past decade her kidnapper was abusive and threatening, and she obeyed him.
I was 15. I can study. I can do nothing. I just did what he wants I did. I don't have light. That's right. I don't have light.
Neighbours say the couple seemed normal and happy, that they even threw parties. But Maribel Garcia, who lived in the same apartment block, says the woman wasn't allowed far out of his sight.
He wouldn't really let her go outside. She was out maybe like for 5 minutes or so, and then he would pull her in. He was always watching, you know, when she was outside. He was looking through the window or looking down at her, and like she would like just look at him up, and then she would go right back in, as if she knew she had to like do what he said.
The man accused of kidnapping and abusing the woman, 41-year-old Isidro Garcia, appeared via video conference in an Orange County courtroom today. Sitting in a wire cage, he appeared to have a translator talking to him while the judge addressed his lawyer. He's facing charges of forcible rape, of lewd acts on a minor, and of kidnapping to commit a sexual offence, and if convicted, faces 19 years in prison. Santa Ana police say that the woman got in touch with her mother after finding her sister on Facebook to wish her a happy birthday in April. It's alleged Garcia had told his victim that her mother had given up looking for her. Corporal Anthony Bertagna says Garcia began brainwashing the girl straight away.
She was a 15-year-old girl that was brought here from Mexico, doesn't speak English. She's now taken away from her family. Told that her family's not looking for her, told her that her family doesn't care, and he's the only one there for her. She doesn't know anybody. The psychological aspect of this plays a big part in this.
Police say the mother showed her daughter news articles written at the time of her disappearance to prove that she had gone to police and filed a missing persons report. It was this that finally convinced her to report Garcia to police. This is Michael Vincent in Washington for AM.
Japan has the world's oldest population. One quarter of its 127 million people is aged 65 or over. Now it's facing a dementia epidemic. Nearly 5 million people live with the condition, and thousands are going missing from their homes and carers every month. Families say the government response to the crisis has been inadequate. North Asia correspondent Matthew Carney reports.
In Japan's second biggest city, Osaka, Atsuko Hajihata is frantically looking for her missing grandfather, Akinori Matsuyama. For the last several months, she's been handing out leaflets on street corners and train stations, asking people to contact her if they see her grandfather. He walked out of the family home in January and has not been seen since. And Atsuko thinks he has dementia.
I feel nervous. I've heard that bodies of drowned people have been found, but maybe he's being looked after by people. I still have hope I'll find him.
Some of the missing turn up in mental institutions or aged care homes. An unidentified man has been living in a nursing home in Osaka after being rescued from a busy highway 2 years ago. He has severe dementia and does not know his name or where he came from. And there's no information that can help identify him. His carer asks him if he can remember anything, but the man does not reply. Tragically, many of the missing are found dead. Kenzo Yoshizawa left his home while his wife was preparing dinner. She wrote his name and address on his shoes, but Kenzo left in his sandals. 3 weeks later, he was found frozen to death beside a river just 500 metres from his home. His wife believed he would return.
I have regret and feel sorry that I wasn't able to find him.
It's hard to get exact figures of how many people with dementia go missing, but police estimates for 2012 are about 10,000. Experts say it's much more, and the problem is only going to get worse. Kumiko Nagata works at one of Tokyo's oldest and biggest aged care facilities.
In Japan, people over 65 exceed 25%, so the number of people missing with dementia will increase rapidly. And these days, old people aren't living with their families. They often live alone or as elderly couples where both might have dementia, so they don't realise if one goes missing.
There is a network for missing persons, but only about 10% of local governments are using it. Most want a new system with much greater cooperation between police and government agencies. In the meantime, communities are taking matters into their own hands. On the outskirts of Tokyo, the volunteer group Missing Persons Search has been set up. Hiroshi Tarara, who runs the organisation, was a police officer for 25 years.
Police don't actively search and only get involved if there has been an unusual death.
Families want practical measures put in place, like GPS devices in shoes, so people living with dementia can be easily found. This is Matthew Carney reporting for AM.
One of Sydney's most respected racehorse trainers, Guy Walter, has died of a suspected heart attack. The 59-year-old had a string of Group 1 winners, most recently on Saturday, with Streamer taking out the Doomben Cup. Tributes are now flowing for a man described as one of the sport's true gentlemen. Rachel Brown reports.
Skeptazza goes on to win it. It's a trifecta for Guy Walter, close for second and third.
One of Guy Walter's biggest moments on a racetrack was taking out the trifecta in the 2005 Doncaster Handicap at Randwick. He was the first trainer in almost 150 years to achieve the feat. The 59-year-old passed away after track work yesterday, suffering a suspected heart attack.
He was a champion trainer of his time. Like other trainers, he didn't get the high-profile horses, but the horses that he did get, he was a master of. And he only just trained a Group 1 winner last week in Brisbane with Streamer, but he had some very, very good horses in Tie the Knot, or even more recently, Appearance.
Racing New South Wales Chief Executive Peter Volandis says Sydney's tight-knit racing family is deeply shocked and saddened by the news. Just 2 months ago, it mourned the death of jockey Nathan Berry. For Guy Walter, Tie the Knot was his life-changing horse. His superannuation, he'd chuckle. It won 13 Group 1 races for more than $6 million in earnings.
He'll make it back-to-back Sydney Cups. He's a real champion. Right up on the fence, Die does it again. Tie the Knot wins his second Mercedes.
Every trainer dreams of having that one special horse, and Mr. Walter recently told Shoalhaven Heads trainer Terry Robinson he wished his colleagues would one day share that good fortune.
The biggest thing about Guy was he always had time for you or for any of the family to stop and say good day, how things are going, have a chat. The last couple of conversations I've had with him about he thinks he's fortunate enough to be part of what, the better part of what he sees in racing.
Guy Walter started his training career with Terry Robinson's late father, Kevin Robinson.
Great trainer, had a great manner about him. He reminded me probably a lot of my father. That's probably why it sort of rocks you a bit. He had a quiet manner about him that went through his horses and he just got the best out of them.
As a young man, he travelled overseas to learn his craft.
He worked for top trainers, including Bart Cummings. He ended up strapping very good horses. One of them was Think Big.
Of his own form, tributes are flooding in on social media, remarking in an industry so cutthroat, he won with grace and lost with dignity. One of the sport's true gentlemen.
He would be the same person to, you know, a dollar punter as he would be to one of the biggest donors he had.
Mr. Volandis adds, as a mark of the man, when Mr. Walter mentored apprentices, he'd insist Racing New South Wales not credit him for the usual cut of their earnings, that the riders should keep it. His wife Wendy will be taking over the stable's operations, but this weekend's race books and form guide will still carry his name as a mark of honour.
Rachel Brown. On the financial markets, in New York, the Dow Jones has closed at 16,543 points. That's up 10 points. The Nasdaq has closed at 4,154. That's up 22 points. And in London, the FT100 has closed at 6,821, pretty much steady. The dollar's buying 92.28 US cents. It's buying 93.89 Japanese yen and 67.6 euro cents. West Texas Intermediate crude oil is selling at $104.12 US a barrel. That is down 40 cents. I'm Chris Yulman. You've been listening to AM, and that is AM for today.